Thank you for attending our session, Surgery Resident Wellbeing, Achieving Quadruple Aim. My name is Edward Shipper. I'm a PGY4 resident at UT Health San Antonio. I think wellness is a hot topic, as we've seen across meetings, especially in the past couple of years. And I think what we want to see is our physician population not just being well, but we want to see them thriving. And so the question is, how do we get there? And for that purpose, we have assembled a group of experts to talk about the topic of wellness. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Goldberg. He is a pediatric orthopedist. He spends every other month at Seattle Children's Hospital, and then when he's not at Seattle Children's, he spends those months at the Schwartz Center for Compassionate Healthcare. Thank you.
It will go on. Thank you. Hey, good afternoon, and thank you for having me speak today. I do not have any relevant financial relationships related to the conversation. So I'm going to try briefly to answer three questions. Very briefly, what is burnout and why is it so bad? And the other speakers will talk more about that. The bulk of the conversation is going to be about why have we in medicine lagged so far behind business and industry in understanding burnout? How did we get to where we are today? And lastly, I'd like to offer the suggestion that modern neuroscience can help us understand burnout and give us a framework to respond to it. So burnout, as you know, is a mental state characterized by emotional exhaustion. I am emotionally depleted by my work. By depersonalization, I see patients not as people. And by a decreased sense of personal accomplishment, I feel ineffective. Not inefficient, I feel ineffective. By physician self-report, we know that burnout is prevalent and it's been getting worse. Classic papers by Schanfeld and his group has shown that in 2011 it was about 45%, increased to 54% by 2014. And a similar fall in satisfaction with your work-life balance. The worsening occurred in all medical specialties. There was a minimal change over this same period of burnout in the U.S. population, in the general working population. The newest report, which just came out this summer by Medscape and the National Physician Burnout and Depression Report, showed again some 29 specialties. Compared to medical specialists, surgeons are in the middle to the lower range of burnout. So we're pretty good. But when asked we're suffering from both burnout and depression, surgeons tended to score higher. The National Survey of Burnout in U.S. General Surgical Residents showed that almost 70% met the criterion for burnout on at least one subscale. A greater proportion of women was 73%, and 44% considered dropping out of their program. No clinical caregiver is immune to burnout. Up to 75% of medical residents report symptoms. More than 35% of nurses report burnout or moral distress. And I want to point out among surgeons, there's a tendency to underestimate our personal burnout. And if you ask the question, do you feel emotionally burned out, it is frequently said no. But if you're asked, are people in your work setting emotionally burned out, there's quite a bit higher. It's not me, it's my team. And so to be aware of that as you review statistics. So there is indeed an epidemic of burnout. In fact, there's rampant burnout among stock photo models who pose as burned out doctors. They are getting so burned out portraying these burned out doctors. So it is truly epidemic. The consequences of physician burnout for patients are well documented: increased medical errors, diminished attentiveness, diminished empathy, diminished compassionate behaviors towards patients. And the most recent report about the medical errors, which came out this summer, was by Chanderfelt and his group, who surveyed about almost 6,700 physicians and did three things. First, he inquired about symptoms of burnout. And then he asked them to rate the hospital safety environment with the classic measurement tool for measuring safety environments, and then asked, did you report a medical error in the last 3 months? After multiple regression analyses and similar, it showed that physician burnout is at least equally responsible for medical errors as unsafe medical workplace conditions. For that, it's a real change where we used to think that it's this environment that made the problem. When people are surveyed, doctors, nurses, patients, 99% agree that compassionate care is important. But in 2011, only 53% of patients and 58% of physicians said the healthcare system provided compassionate care, and this has gotten worse. In 2017, only 47% of physicians and only 40% of nurses felt that the healthcare system provides compassionate care. That's us looking at where we're working. And you may be familiar with this drawing that appeared in JAMA. It is a drawing of a 10-year-old in the doctor's office. Here she is, sitting on the table. Here's mom. Here's her sister holding her baby sister. And here's her doctor with his back to her. The consequences of burnout for physicians and nurses can be even more dire than for patients. The prevalence of depression and depressive symptoms among residents is between 20 and 40%. And you're all well aware that the rate of physician suicide is increasing. 400 physicians die by suicide each year. A way to look at that is the entire medical school each year dies by suicide. Roughly 500,000 patients need to seek a new physician. Now, both industry and retail business have long been aware of burnout. The original works refer to it as strain, workforce strain. It was subsequently labeled burnout, emotional exhaustion, moral distress, compassion fatigue, low engagement, poor safety culture, a number of monikers. But it was called strain. 1979, Robert Karasek, who was at Columbia University, said that workplace strain is a function of how demanding a person's job is and how much control the person has over their responsibilities. They made a four corners, and for those that had high responsibility and low autonomy were at risk for psychological and physical stress. So this was placed into the industry literature, and many companies modeled this principle. We in medicine, on the other hand, went to clinical standard work. Reduce variation, it improves efficiency, it reduces cost, it improves safety, it better work role definition. But Clinical standard work reduces flexibility, reduces control, reduces autonomy, and preserves responsibility and accountability, but with a lack of authority. A national survey of burnout among United States general surgical residents said burnout was rampant among general surgical residents. Greater likelihood with increasing age, lower likelihood in PGY5 as compared to PGY1, and residents planning to enter private practice had higher levels of burnout than those planning to enter academic practice. How do we reconcile this? I might suggest that increased autonomy and work control of chief residents compared to interns and junior residents may have accounted for them feeling better. And similarly, the perception that private practice affords greater autonomy and flexibility may have led them into making that choice. In 1981, Christina Maslach, the social psychologist and who wrote the Maslach Burnout Inventory, said, "Burnout is not a problem of people, but a problem of the social environment in which they work." And what she did is looked at a chronic mismatch between people and their work setting, saying that it is an issue with workload, control, lack of autonomy, lack of resources, reward, insufficient financial or social reward, loss of positive connection in your community, and feeling of unfairness, inequity in workload, pay, and promotion, and a mismatch in values, a conflict with the individual and the organizational values. I might suggest this is currently where we are in our organizations, that our values are not in perfect match with the organizations. We don't see metrics related to our well-being or metrics to how we are doing. And if one looks at the article recently published by Sinsky, Allocation of Physician Time in Ambulatory Practice, it showed that for every 1 hour in face-to-face time with your patients were 2 hours in the electronic health record and doing desk work. That is a mismatch between what we're doing and want to do and our values and how the time is distributed. In 2001, the industry was continuing to move along. They developed the job demands resource model, so-called JDR model. It said workforce strain results from increasing job demands while decreasing resources. And when they looked at industries, it was predictive of absenteeism, turnover, emotional exhaustion, job engagement, and this was studied in human services, in manufacturing, and in transportation. So here is this model that says workforce burnout increases with increasing job demands and decreasing resources. So what did we do? We did not choose the jobs demand model. We looked to Toyota. If any of you are involved with lean thinking in your organization, lean manufacturing, doing more with less by employing lean thinking. Lean manufacturing involves never-ending efforts to eliminate waste and reduce resources. Continuous improving lean manufacturing. And there is it's been introduced as a welcome to many, many hospitals. And the model that was used was Toyota manufacturing. I might argue that that's not the best model. One industry process is a better model for healthcare. It's not car manufacturing, where they're all Corollas coming in just different colors and can be looked at by only one. It's more like baggage claim. We have our patients and bags coming in various states of disrepair, going to any number of different places, with different goals and with intense family involvement. That is not a model for lean manufacturing. Edward Deming, the father of total quality management, said bad systems bring out the worst in good people. And for, I would recommend a good read is An American Sickness. Its conclusion is that while we have become more like industry with billing and corporate practices and efficiency, we have become less like industry with customer service and workforce well-being. Howard Schultz, in 1988, when he started Starbucks, said, "You can't expect your employees to exceed the expectations of your customers if you don't exceed the employees' expectations of management. The experience of the worker drives the experience of the customer." And you see this when you go to Starbucks, when you go to Costco, and you go to places where there is great value placed on the worker. And I would argue that the experience of the clinician drives the experience of the patient and family. And if we are going to look at improving our workplace, we have to take into account that is our experience is going to drive family experience. They can't go down and say, improve your HCAPs, improve your FES scores, without improving the health and wellness of the worker, the clinician. I might even suggest radically that we should stop calling things patient-centered care and start calling them human-centered care, because there is more than one person in every interaction that we have in care of our patients. I'd like to take a moment to say that, talking about compassion, I'm always worried in the surgical audience that it's just so squishy, but that there is a social and neuroscience basis of empathy and compassion, and that we're hardwired. And a compassion, by definition, is the deep feeling that arises when confronted with another's suffering, coupled with a strong desire to alleviate that suffering. That is that coupled with, it's the feeling coupled with the desire to alleviate that suffering. And Tanya Singer and her group at Max Planck Institute, who has doing high-level neuroscience and functional MRI, showed that empathy and compassion has a core neural network involving the anterior insula and the cingulate, and that when you experience empathy for another's pain, it activates regions where you have a direct pain experience. A physical pain experience, and one neuron over is the pain experience from empathy. And when compassion is activated, the ability to help someone to relieve that suffering, what is seen, what is lit up, is the area of the brain involved with reward and positive affect. So I would like to suggest that a simpler view as a cause of burnout is burnout occurs when you know what the patients need, but you're unable to give it to them. They need 10 more minutes in clinic or at the bedside. You know it. They need a bit more patient education, time to tell them again, to have conversations. They need medications, tests, and services that are not covered by their insurance carrier. And they need consultants that are not available till next February. And that this is what creates the feeling of ineffectiveness, being ineffective, not inefficient. And that is where burnout is seeing its origin. And I'd like to suggest that compassion is the antidote for burnout. And compassion is where we should focus as we look at doing something. Harvey Feinberg at the Institute of Medicine said the greatest inhibitor to individual caregivers showing compassion is that they themselves are disrespected, under stress, and not permitted to express their full professional engagement and responsibility. That is what's putting us part in the soup. And I would like us to start thinking, we have been measuring burnout, what are we going to do about it? What type of framework might there be? And I, being a pediatric surgeon, compassionate care, anti-burnout caregiver well-being toolbox. And the pieces in that are three layers: the individual, caregiver, the team or unit that you work on, and leadership. At the caregiver are interventions to prevent and reduce physician burnout, things like mindfulness, stress management, small groups, resilience, this building of resilience, and we hear a great deal about that. Personal resilience contributes to physician well-being, a good study. But no amount of resilience can withstand a toxic or non-supportive environment. It's like making the canary in the coal mine stronger. I don't think we should be in the business of stronger canaries. What we need to do is look at ways to make the coal mine less toxic. 80% of professional burnout is attributable to organizational factors. We need system of care that support our ability to connect with families. At the team level, we have to implement programs that nourish provider compassion. There has to be an opportunity for caregivers to have an escape, to have their own humanity reaffirmed. We spend so little time talking with each other. Hospitals have gotten rid of old-fashioned doctor dining rooms and nurses in doctor's lounge. It's an expectation we take lunch at our computer. But there are some things that organizations can do. Schwartz Round's second victim programs, Tea for the Soul, Code Lavender. We have to think that that's part of the component as well. I want to put in the plug that Schwartz Rounds is a multidisciplinary conference to share and talk about the experience of caring for patients. It's rather than the patient's story, it's the caregiver's story. And about 450 hospitals in the United States, about 150 in UK, have Schwartz Rounds. And at the leadership level, we have to look at this level as well. There are leadership opportunities to support the delivery of compassionate care. There are many. I just briefly pick three: that we need to monitor the emotional health of the workforce. We need to check on how we are doing. This is happening in colleges. At Drexel University, is a checkup from the neck up. It's a kiosk that answers some questions, and it says, and it screens for eating disorders, for PTSD, for anxiety. And we ought to do something like that. This is flu season. We're all online waiting for our flu shots. Check for TB. And the line is such that I certainly have time to fill out a checkup from the neck up, if only someone would ask. Policy after adverse events. This is only something an organization can do. We know that when Sullenberger's U.S. airplane landed in the Hudson River, it was a near disaster. All lives were saved. And what happened? Sullenberger afterwards had to go on 6 weeks required debriefing, understanding the emotional impact. He, the co-pilot, the people in the control tower, because they know that you must attend to their well-being before you go back to work. Managing an adverse event and a hospital story. We were doing a decompression of the foramen magnum on a patient with a skeletal dysplasia, my patient. Patient had an arrest and fortunately was resuscitated from this air embolus. We went to surgeon, and I, as the referring doctor, went to talk to the parents. And during the conversation, a beeper went off that the next case was ready. You're slowing down the OR. And the same OR team and anesthesia team went into the next spine case. We can't make those changes. That's organizational leadership. We need to address the electronic medical record and look at how we got here. in a recently published article, the number of words in a visit that you do when you see the patient in clinic was studied. The clinical notes in some 50 hospitals in the United States and in hospitals that were overseas in Australia, UK, and Europe. And clinical notes in the United States are 4 times longer than those in other countries. It goes from about 1,000 characters in Australia to almost 7,000 characters here. Almost all of that due to reimbursement and compliance documentation. We can't change that. That's an organizational responsibility that we need to lean on them to show this evidence. And there is executive leadership and physician well-being. There is 9 organizational strategies in this wonderful proceedings from Mayo Clinic. So, in conclusion, I think that burnout is a problem. It is, we know the cause of it. I'd like to suggest that it has because we're hardwired and that the time has come to start acting on this. And perhaps this framework of leadership addressing team and unit addressing and caregiver might give us something where we could work together. Thank you very much.